Good morning, brothers and sisters. One thing I really like about the start of a new year is that we get to start doing the Psalms in our daily Bible readings. And I really like the Psalms. And we get to read it for a good 3 months. In fact, my dad would always say, when the Psalms is done, spring will be here. But I'm always like, hey, when Christmas is done, we get to start the Psalms. And one of the reasons I really like the Psalms is that when you don't really know what to read, if you open up your Bible to the Psalms and just start reading, you'll probably find something helpful, which I think is why God nicely put the Psalms sort of in the middle of the Bible. So if you're the type of person who's like, where do I start reading? And you just like randomly open the Bible, you might end up in Psalms. You might end up in Proverbs too, which is also useful. But a lot of times you end up in Psalms, and it's helpful. I think it's one of those little details when, you know, God was making sure that when they put the Bible together, it just so happened that Psalms was in the middle, so that that would work out. However, just because it's helpful doesn't mean that all the Psalms are light and happy. In fact, there's definitely bits of the Psalms where the author, often David, he's struggling with depression, where he feels abandoned, where all the bad people seem to be winning and doing evil things and getting away with it. And so he's crying out to God for help. And that's another reason why I find the Psalms awesome, because the Psalms are real. The Bible is not presenting some idealized version of the world where everything is all perfect and happy and everything always works out, because that's not the world we live in. The world we live in has a lot of things that are unhappy and sad and not good and problematic and is often evil and ugly and unfair. And real people, maybe not people in books, but real people, they suffer with depression and anxiety. They don't always win. Sometimes bad people seem to do well and good people don't. And it's tough and confusing and hard. And the Psalms actually includes that. Because sometimes you're struggling with real issues. And if you read the Bible, and the Bible always talked about how this Superman went and solved all his problems because he's Superman, I mean, it might be nice to think about it, but it's not relatable. It's not real. It's not helpful for this world we live in, because this world we live in doesn't work that way. Sometimes things are actually really hard. And it's kind of interesting. I've been doing a lot of reading and watching about Japan recently, and I watched this video where they were interviewing random people in Japan about their religious beliefs. And in Japan, people don't really have religious beliefs. So they had this one funny section where they asked a couple people, so what religion are you? And they said, I'm Buddhist. So what does that mean to you? So what's different about your life because you're Buddhist? Nothing. Why are you saying you're Buddhist? Well, we have a Buddhist temple in our house, so I think that makes us Buddhist. So they're not terribly religious, and they don't really think much of different ones. He asked him about Christianity. He was like, I think it's really cool. Why do you think it's so cool? Well, their buildings are so cool. The way they're constructed, they look all foreign. But one comment that I did enjoy was there was this one girl, and they were talking about Christianity, and she was like, you know, I really like the stories in the Bible. I would almost think that they were real. They seem so true to life. And that's actually one of the differences between the Bible and like Buddhist tracts or Hindu suras and things like that. The Bible isn't written about a fake fantasy world where bad things don't exist. It's written about the real world by people who live in the real world, where people had the same problems we have. And that's why the Psalms are so relatable, because you read the Psalms and you know that they're coming from the heart of a real person who is struggling with real difficulties. And that's what we see in Psalm 14, which is what we read for our daily reading today. In Psalm 14, it's not giving an idealistic view of the world. It's giving, unfortunately, kind of the opposite. Let me read it again for you in case you missed it the first time. The fool says in his heart, "There is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of men to see if there are any who understand who seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one." Now, I'm sure some of you are reading that and are like, wait a second, James, you just made this huge point about how the Psalms are real. And here it's saying that there's no one who does good, not even one. That's not real. There are legitimately people who do good things in this world. Sure, there might be bad things too, but there's good things as well. This world is not a complete trash heap. And you'd actually be right, but you're kind of missing the point. Because another thing to realize when reading Psalms is an emotional book. It's written from the gut. It's not written to be, like, logically consistent. It's written to express someone's feelings. And feelings are often wrong. They're often extreme. The world we live in is full of nuance and grays and all that, but sometimes when you're sad, you are sad and everything's terrible. Or if you're mad, that person is completely evil. And that's the way emotions are. Emotions go to extremes, and that's what we're seeing here in Psalms, because it's written from emotionally. It might not be logically true, but man, that's how you feel right then. And that's the way Psalm 14 is written. Psalm 14 is written emotionally. Someone is going, there is no one who does good, not even one. That's not true. In fact, if you read the next couple of verses, it says that's not true. Verse 4, have they no knowledge, all the evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the Lord? There they are in great terror, for God is with the generation of the righteous. Note that last bit, the generation of the righteous. There are actually good people. In fact, there's not just one, there's an entire generation of evil people. Yes, there are evildoers out there, and they are decidedly evil, but they're not God's people. They are persecuting God's people, but they're not his people. His people are the righteous. There's a generation of them, and God will defend them against these evildoers. So if you just read that one little bit, you might go, oh, this is illogical. He's being extreme. And he is being extreme, and he is being illogical. But that's the emotional part of it. Psalms is written from the gut. It's poetry, not prose. If you read it like a mathematical statement, you'll end up with inconsistencies all over the place. But if you read it like the desperate cry of a broken heart, then you'll understand it a lot better. And that's also, I think, how we need to understand the words in Psalm 14, where it says, there is no God. This is not a logical statement. This is an emotional statement. The focus here isn't theology. It's practice. The fool here is saying that there is no one who's going to hold him accountable for his actions. He's not making a theological statement about whether there's one God or zero gods or three gods or 10 gods. He's not talking about whether God looks like a lion or a cow or is invisible. What he's talking about is whether or not there's somebody who's in charge who's going to hold him accountable for his actions. And actually, the way God is used in the Psalms is often used this way, which is perhaps not the way we would often think about it in the way we use God as Americans or New Zealanders, but the way it seems to be used in the Psalms. So in Psalm 82, it's also used this way. This is probably the most famous one, where if you read Psalm 82 with the wrong understanding of God, you get very confused. So Psalm 82, I'm actually going to read the whole thing because it's pretty short, another advantage of the Psalms. I'm going to read it also out of a fairly literal translation. God stands in the assembly of God. He judges in the midst of the gods. Until when will you judge unjustly and lift up the faces of the wicked? Judge the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Save out of the hand of the wicked. They neither know nor will understand. They walk in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I have said, you are gods, and all of you are sons of the Most High. But you shall die as men, and fall like one of the rulers. Rise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all the nations. So the weird thing about this psalm is we have God talking to other gods. If there's only one God, how is God talking to other gods? What's going on here? Well, if we look at this psalm a little bit more closely, though, we can see some attributes of these other gods that he's talking to. One is that they're supposed to be judging people. But, so verse 3, they're supposed to be defending the poor and the fatherless and doing justice to the afflicted and needy. But they're also doing a bad job of it. Verse 2, how long will you judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? And they're also going to die. Verse 7, you shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. So clearly, these gods he's talking to, they're not actually immortal beings. They're going to die, and they're doing the same sort of stuff we would say human judges do, or human kings. They're supposed to be judging people and behaving fairly and helping people who, like the fatherless and the needy, have no other helper, but they're not doing that. And so it's like, basically, like you have a judicial system or a police system that's not doing its job. It's supposed to be helping the people who have no other help, but instead they are behaving unjustly and are not giving justice to people. And as a result, God, the ultimate person in charge, is like, I've given you jurisdiction over this people. You are in some way a leader, a lord, a god to these people under your jurisdiction. But because you aren't doing your control, me, the ultimate God, the God of heaven, the ultimate judge, I'm going to judge you because you aren't doing your job as judges of your little territory under here. And hence it ends with, arise, O God, judge the earth, for thou shalt inherit all nations. These gods he's talking to have limited areas of jurisdiction. They're like kings of these nations, but God is the God of all the nations and is the one in charge. And this is, again, if you take it as a pure theoretical statement about what is a God and what, theological statement about what is God and what isn't, then you're going to get really confused. If you take it more emotionally, God in the sense of big, powerful thing over me, then it makes a little more sense. And something also I find interesting is that this sort of concept of there's a God over you can extend to what you might even call a strictly atheist state. You may have heard of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, otherwise known as the USSR, and it was an officially atheist state. They not only didn't endorse any particular god, they said that there was no god. Taught everyone in their schools. Communism was the official political view, and as part of communism, there was no god. Religion was just an opiate of the people. But if you actually lived in Stalinist Russia, well, let me tell you, read to you this rather terrifying story from the Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I think that's how you say his name. At the conclusion of the conference, a tribute to Comrade Stalin was called for. Of course, everyone stood up, just as everyone had leaped to his feet during the conference at every mention of his name. For 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, the stormy applause rising to an ovation continued. But palms were getting sore and raised arms were already aching, and the older people were panting from exhaustion. It was becoming unsufferably silly, even to those who really adored Stalin. However, who would dare to be the first to stop? After all, NKVD men were standing in the hall applauding and watching to see who would quit first. And in the obscure small hall, unknown to the leader, the applause went on. 6, 7, 8 minutes. They were done for. Their goose was cooked. They couldn't stop now till they had collapsed with heart attacks. In the rear of the hall, which was crowded, they could, of course, cheat a little bit, clap less frequently, less vigorously, not so eagerly. But up there with the presidium where everyone could see them, the director of the local paper factory, an independent and strong-minded man, stood with the presidium. Aware of all the falsity and all the impossibility of the situation, he still kept on applauding. 9 minutes, 10. In anguish, he watched the secretary of the district party committee. The latter dared not stop. Insanity to the last man. With make-believe enthusiasm on their faces, looking at each other with faint hope, the district leaders were just going to go on and on, applauding till they fell where they stood, till they were carried out of the hall on stretchers. And even then, those who left would not falter. Then, after 11 minutes, the director of the paper factory assumed a businesslike expression and sat down in his seat. And oh, a miracle took place. Where had the universal, uninhibited, indescribable enthusiasm gone? To a man, everyone else stopped dead and sat down. They had been saved. The squirrel had been smart enough to jump off his revolving wheel. That, however, was how they discovered who the independent people were, and that was how they went about eliminating them. That same night, the factory director was arrested. They easily pasted 10 years on him on the pretext of doing something quite different. But after he had signed Form 206, the final document of the interrogation, his interrogator reminded him, "Don't ever be the first to stop applauding." The USSR may have been an officially atheist state, but believe me, in Soviet Russia, there was a god. His name was Stalin, and you either worshipped him or you died. But the reason the USSR became that totalitarian police state, became such a horrible place to live, was actually because that man on top, Joseph Stalin, didn't believe there was a god. Ironically, in his early years, he actually went to a seminary to study to be a priest. You can find his poetry, which was actually fairly well regarded in Georgia, where he grew up, to be Georgia near Russia, not Georgia, United States. And it's spiritual stuff talking about God. But while he was in that seminary, he came to a conclusion that there was no God. There's a quote I found where he says to another student, "God's not unjust. He doesn't actually exist. We've been deceived. If God existed, he'd have made the world more just. I'll lend you a book and you'll see." And that's apparently a teenage Stalin after reading The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. So to Stalin, who was the man at the top, the god of this whole society, there was no one holding him accountable. He might have been God in the Soviet Union. People were worshiping him and adoring him on pain of death. But he himself had no God. And as a result, he was one of the most brutal dictators that this world has ever seen, executing anyone who might have resisted him. And then after he was done executing them, he then executed the people who executed them. There were about 800,000 executions during his rule of the Soviet Union, and about 700,000 of them were during his Great Purge. He put the Soviet Union through a famine twice and refused to buy food from outside to help his people who were starving, because that would be admitting that communism wasn't perfect. He was a brutal, brutal man. When his son Yakov was captured by the Nazis and they tried to use him as a bargaining chip, he said, "I have no son named Yakov." But for those who lived in the Soviet Union during his long rule, they may have asked the same thing the psalmist asks in Psalm 10, where they're living in this horrible, horrible regime. And they're saying things like, because there were Christians, a lot of Christians who lived in Russia. And they would say things perhaps like in Psalm 10, where it says, "Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes they have devised. For the wicked boasts of the desires of his soul, and one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God." And so that's what you had. You had a regime which is saying, there was no God. There's no one accountable to me. You might be accountable to us, but we're accountable to no one, and we're going to do anything you want. And so the people at the bottom, the people being oppressed, they would be asking, if there is a God, why is this the case? Why are things so unjust? Why is God not judging Stalin for his actions? Stalin is horrible. And yet there seems to be no judge, nobody who's coming down and stopping him. He just does anything he wants. And they might even come to the same conclusion as Stalin, that, you know what, this world is unjust. And it's unjust not because God is unjust, but because there is no God. There's nobody holding anyone accountable, so I might as well just do whatever I want, because nobody is going to hold me accountable. There's no God up there. But, as we know from Psalm 14, that would be foolish thinking, because there actually is a God. He's a merciful God, one who is slow to anger, patient, always ready to forgive, even with people like Stalin. But that doesn't mean that he will let the guilty go unpunished. And the nice thing for us is that we're not living in Soviet Russia right now. We can read the history books about what happened to Soviet Russia, but guess what? There is no Soviet Russia anymore. Stalin died. There's debate about whether he was murdered or not, but he definitely died. There's no Stalin anymore. His successor, Khrushchev, exposed all the evil things that Stalin had done. They went through a process known as de-Stalinization, where Khrushchev took down this whole cult of personality that had been created around Stalin and told everyone that Stalin was a horrible person. Stalin was taken out of the mausoleum where he'd been buried and was instead just buried in the necropolis with a location marked only by a simple bust. The city named after him, Stalingrad, was renamed Volgograd. And a few years after that, the USSR, the state he'd created, collapsed. Communism was discredited. Now we only have Russia, which is smaller and is not even a communist state. God is patient, but he will judge the wicked. He'll probably take longer than you want him to. But still, in the end, Stalin is dead. What he created is gone. There was a God, and he did judge him for his actions. And that is why the Psalms are so helpful. Because when you read a psalm, a lot of them, they start off expressing the very human emotions we feel about the reality around us, expressing the thoughts we feel when we're tired, when we're sad, when we're angry, when we're disappointed, when we look at the world and it looks unjust and unfair, not the way it's supposed to be. They start off that way. But almost invariably, they then turn hopeful, because the psalm then remembers that despite this unjust world we may seem to be in, there actually is a God there, and it's not going to stay that way. We see that in Psalm 14. It starts off with, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good." But it doesn't end with that. We kept reading. If you come to the end of the psalm, Verse 5, there were they in great fear, for God is in the generation of the righteous. You have shamed the counsel of the poor, because the Lord is his refuge. Oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion. When the Lord bringeth back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice and Israel shall be glad. It starts off depressive, but it doesn't end that way, because there is a God. The fool may say that there is none, but there is a God, and you just need to wait for him. And we see that in other psalms as well. In Psalm 82, which we also looked at, it starts off with these judges being unfair, not judging properly, but there is a God, and they would be judged. And so it ends with, "Arise, O God, judge the earth, for thou shalt inherit all nations." And probably most famously, we see this in Psalm 22. Psalm 22, that psalm that starts off with the words, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring?" It starts off with the psalmist crying out to God for help because God has forsaken him, but it doesn't end that way. It ends with Psalm 22, verse 31. "They shall come and proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, that he has done it." And of course, the reason why Psalm 22 is so famous is because when Jesus Christ, our Lord, was in pain, when he was overwhelmed, when he was literally being crucified, where he went to was Psalm 22. A psalm that, yes, was literally prophetic of where he was, but most importantly, I think, a psalm that started off with pain but ended with joy. A psalm that would help give him the patience he would need to wait on that cross in pain and suffering for God's will to be done. Knowing that even though it wasn't his will, even though it was not happening nearly as fast as he wanted it to, God's will would be done and salvation would come. And so, when you're facing similar difficulties, I recommend going to the Psalms. That's what Jesus did. If you follow in his example, try going to the Psalms when things are hard. You can read them. If you can't read them, something I also recommend is sing them. I don't know when Jesus was on the cross when he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Whether he sung it or not. I do know, though, that he spoke it in Aramaic because the people who were listening to him didn't quite understand it properly. They thought he was crying to Elijah, which is basically they didn't understand Aramaic. But he was speaking in the language he would have been brought up with. Maybe he was singing it. I don't know. But I know for me, I find it really helpful to listen to the Psalms and have them in my head. And then when times get really tough, then that's what comes up in my head and I can sing it. And there are some great CDs put out by the Handsworth Christadelphians. You may have heard of them. They're called Voice of His Word, Recounting His Praise and Refuge. And they're basically psalms set to music. They've got a few other passages in there. But most of them are the psalms set to music, straight out of the New International Version. If you like having the psalms in your head, I recommend them. If that's not your style of music, there's lots of other ones out there, of groups out there as well, that take the psalms and put them to music. And getting the psalms in your head, I think, is really important. Because there might be a time when you have that sort of stalling moment, when you look at the world and you go, this is unjust. What's going on? Is there actually a God out there? And if you have the Psalms in your head, rather than becoming a fool like Stalin, you'll remember Psalm 14. You'll remember that God will bring justice, perhaps not as quickly as you want, but there is a God in heaven. He is in charge, and he will bring justice. And so you'll be patient, like Jesus on the cross when he was going through a really difficult time. And like Jesus, you will have a much better future than Stalin, because Stalin may have ruled a vast empire, but it collapsed. The Lord Jesus will rule a much larger one, and it will stand forever.